Tough Guy seems to focus more on masculinity and male roles in the media. And for the benefit of the listeners who haven't seen the film, could you just briefly surmise the film?
Yeah, Tough Guys is really about the connection between normal masculinity and violence. The way in which we're raising boys to become men puts a high premium on intimidation, on power, on control, and on violence. And in that sense, we shouldn't be very surprised at the levels of violence that we see in society, in that they're connected to how we're raising boys to become men. I really sort of, this became clear to me when the film is with a person called Jackson Katz, who is nationally known as an educator around anti-violence stuff. And he called me in the spring of 1998 after one of the school shootings in the spring of 1998. And he said, wanted us to work on a film together, because he said, this is a teachable moment in the culture. And we are not having the kind of debate we need to have about this. Because he said, all the headlines in the newspapers and on television, etc., was about, you know, kids killing kids and, you know, what's wrong with the problem of youth violence, you know, why are our children acting this way? And he said to me on the phone, it was one of those key sort of defining moments for me, he said, this is not kids killing kids, this is boys killing boys and boys killing girls. And we said that, it was just actually absolutely so clear that, in fact, the question of violence, when you start looking at it closely, you know, 90% of violence, you know, whether it is murder, whether it is assault, whether it is sexual assault, whether it is robbery, whether it is, I mean, any kind of violence you want to look at, between 85 to 99% of that violence is committed by men. So when 90% of violence is committed by one gender, you've got to take a close look at how we are raising boys to become men, because that violence is connected to that upbringing. And so the film Tough Guys is about looking at the cultural context within which masculinity is connected to intimidation and to power and to violence, and how we're producing violent boys and violent men, not as extreme, not as something that is, you know, as an aberration, but as something that is absolutely normal. And so we shouldn't be surprised at the levels of violence we have and the levels of male violence we have, given the cultural environment that encourages that.
Would you say masculinity is a social construct?
Yes, masculinity is a cultural and social construct. I mean, many people have talked about masculinity and femininity, you know, as performances, that we perform what it means to be a man and what it means to be a woman. Now, that's not to say there's no differences between men and women. You know, as we pop out of the womb, you know, physically we look very different. We have different body parts. But, you know, most of the evidence shows that whatever difference there is between men and women is in fact constructed by the society and is not given by nature, is not given by biology. And most of the recent work on this has used the concept of performance, that what we're doing is performing a role, and we learn that role from the culture around us. So we learn how to be men, we learn how to be women from the dominant messages that are there in the mass media. And my work has sort of looked at that, as we looked at both how girls are encouraged to take on a particular notion of femininity, and now with Tough Guys, how boys are encouraged and are really channeled into very, very narrow ways of thinking about how they can be human beings in this culture.
The Tough Guys itself, you mentioned last night that it was a performance, a way for boys and men to perform masculinity through power and violence, and you argued that masculinity, like this, is not natural. And there are those who would say that violence is a natural part of maleness, that you and I, for instance, as men, are genetically inclined toward violence and assault and rape and all that. How would you respond to those people who take a pseudo or a scientific approach and claim that it is genetically encoded in us?
I don't think there's actually very much scientific about it. I think most of it is sort of based on common sense assumptions of male violence. I mean, the first thing I would say is, you know, if violence is so connected to male biology, then why are the majority of men, in fact, non-violent? when, again, when we talk about violence being, you know, so much violence being committed by men, we have to remember at the same time, I mean, it's the, you know, is the glass half full, is the glass half empty? There's a lot of violence, but in fact, the vast majority of men are non-violent. If it was encoded in our genes, why should that be the case? I mean, there may well be, you know, there may well be, again, I don't want to say there's no physical differences, that it's, you know, absolutely everything is cultural. I think that will be an extreme, yeah, and a wrong position to take. For a lot of the scientific, a lot of this new debates about, you know, whether violence is encoded in male genes, actually, essentially comes down to a discussion of one thing, which is testosterone. And the evidence seems to show that boys have more testosterone in their bodies than girls do. And then the assumption is made that this is what then leads to aggressiveness, this is what leads to violence. But one of the things we know now from our research is that biological predispositions only ever work themselves out in cultural and social contexts. They never work themselves out in isolation. They always are shaped within a very, very particular context. You know, and there's not much you can do about biology, but there's a lot you can do about culture, and there's a lot you can do about society. So even if you think there is some biological basis to this, and I think that's a very, very small amount, but even if you think that, you still have to pay attention to the particular context within that's played out. So even if you believe in biology, you still should be an activist around the issue of the images that we see, around the issue of what is considered to be normal masculinity. That is, what is there in the culture that exacerbates that tendency, if there is such a tendency? But again, I don't think there is. You know, I think the discussion around biology is meant to deflect us away from doing anything in this, in the present world. It's a way to say, look, there's not much you can do. Men are beasts. Men are just violent from the start. All you can do is try and, you know, control them. And I think that's a very, very dangerous... I mean, it's a very conservative reactionary view that says you can't change the world. The world is always changed. The world can always be changed. And one of the things I always want to insist with people I speak to and with my students when I teach is, look, the world has been made by someone and it can be changed by someone. And if you don't change it, then someone else will. So, but in that sense, it's a very conservative view that says the world can't be changed. It can be changed. At the same time, this is a very dangerous theory for boys and for men, because if it's in the genes, if it's in the biology, and you can't do anything about it, then the only thing you can do is control men. The only thing you can do is drug them, which is what we've tended to do. I mean, you know, the amount of Ritalin that is prescribed to young boys, yeah, it's just out of sight in this society. I mean, it's trying to find, you know, a biological chemical solution to a social problem, and we are always destined to fail when that happens. You can drug people, you can lock them up, you know, you can execute them, and that's essentially the tact that we've chosen in society. And I think that's the biological argument is a very, very dangerous argument for boys. It's often presented in a way that says this is an argument that's pro-male, because it shows that men can't help themselves. That, yeah. But it's not. It's actually a very, very anti-male argument, because the implications of that argument are nothing but negative for most men.
Speaking of things not being quite as they seem, Howard Stern, for instance, gets a lot of credit for being a rebel and an anti-establishment figure. You see him in a different way.
Yeah, the idea that Howard Stern is sort of, you know, cutting edge and cool and anti-establishment figure is just, yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, PR on the part of Howard Stern. I mean, he sort of presents himself as, you know, against the mainstream, but when you look at his messages around gender especially, I mean, what he's reflecting there is straightforward sexism. And in fact, you know, it's very significant that most of Howard Stern's audience, you know, is young, white males. And I think we should always look to see if someone is popular, who are they popular with? And there may be a few women who like him, but the vast majority of his audience is young, white males. And so we have to ask, what's Howard Stern doing that's getting young, white men to listen to him in such large numbers? And what Howard Stern does is he presents a world. I mean, Stern, if you wanted an image of Stern, I mean, Stern is someone who represents a culture that is scared stiff of new gender relations, that's scared stiff of the revolution that feminism has made possible, that's scared stiff of strong women and independent women, and is scared stiff of actually having relationships that are interdependent and that are based on equality. And what Howard Stern says is, look, in the last 20 years, the gender world may be changing all around you, but you listen to the Howard Stern show, and it's like going back to the 1950s. The gender world on the Howard Stern show is a very, very stereotypical, old-fashioned, traditional world in which women know their place, they're there for sex, they're there to be degraded, and they're there to be looked at. And the sad thing is that gets an audience in this time. But again, if you wanted to really, if you really want to find out what Howard Stern was really about, just look at the comments that he made after the Columbine shootings. It's one of the great censored stories of last year, actually, that Howard Stern's comments didn't get wider distribution and there wasn't discussion about them. Because, what he said, as soon as the Columbine stuff happened when he was on the air, instead of identifying with the girls and boys running out of the school, who Stern identified with was the shooters, was with Harris and Klebold. And he said, he said these guys are real losers because, before killing these girls and before killing these boys, they didn't rape them. If he'd been them, then he would have raped the girls before he would have killed them. That tells you something about the mentality that Howard Stern is coming from. To think of Howard Stern as an anti-authority rebel, what a rebel. What does he do with the Columbine incident? He makes a rape joke. To the extent that people buy into this notion of him as a radical, they bought into the public relations that he's spinning. You should listen closely to what he's saying rather than how he positions himself.
Going back over the last 20 years, you mentioned there's been a drastic change in gender roles. As far as images of men and women go on television, men have gotten much larger. We saw this in the excerpts from your film last night. The wrestlers of 20 or 30 years ago were much smaller, less toned than the behemoths of today. Women, full-figured women, were much more popular in the past, and now they're what we call heroin chic, very, very tiny women. Why are these images out there? What brought about the change? What makes them so popular? And how are they connected to power and masculinity?
I mean, it's really always interesting to look at how patterns operate in pop culture and historical patterns. And again, when you look at images of men, they've just become... In the film, the section we put it in, we've titled Upping the Ante. And the examples we use are, if you look at Batman from the 1960s and Adam West as Batman to, the modern incarnations of Batman in the movies, the modern Batman is much muscular, is more rugged, is much harder. If you look at Superman, again from the 50s to Christopher Reeve, the image is totally different. If you look at wrestling, it's absolutely, when you look back, Jesse Ventura, and to the time when he was popular, he's called Jesse the Body Ventura, but in fact his body would be nothing these days. His body would be absolutely normal, or actually less than normal in what passes for wrestling these days. So something is going wrong. Something is up. Something is happening in culture in which the stakes in masculinity have really been raised. At the same time, images of women have gone the opposite way. They've gone from being, full-figured women that had some presence in the world, that took up space, to being, the waifs of today. Whether it's Calista Flockhart or Jennifer Love Hewitt is a good example. I mean, she's very thin except for breasts. And so you have this sort of unnatural body for women nowadays, where they're very, very thin except for having very large breasts, which come from breast implants with almost everyone. Britney Spears is another example of that kind of body makeup. Now the question is why? Why have we seen these two twin sort of movements? Why have men gotten bigger and women, you know, have taken up less, you know, physical space. You know, one place to look at the answer is